Hey, Internet friends. Uncle Sam fried the bankman and Bernie Madoff with all your money. The people who didn't trust the Federal Reserve Bank invested in cryptocurrency and gave their money to a guy named Bankman. Who is writing these scripts? The same people who wrote Game of Thrones Season 8? Because they're truly awful. This is going to be a little watch party video of all the things and updates I didn't get to say this week because, you know, when I'm on a story, I hyperfixate until I never think another thought about it again. Yes, we're still on the FTX fallout, and yes, that is my toddler in the background destroying things. Let me know if you like these kinds of wrap-up watch party videos. I could do them every now and again if you're into it. This whole week, I've been reading about Sam Bankman-Fried's early life, and no, not that Wikipedia early life. But something that stuck out to me was this whole write-up about his stint in summer math camp where he met his future co-CEO and co-founders of FTX. This really reminded me of a video I did about how major players of Silicon Valley like Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin and celebrities like Lady Gaga all went to a camp for gifted children, which basically just ended up being a recruitment for government agents. Do you ever wonder about the person you could have become if your potential was fully realized and you were given the space and tools to unlock the resources tucked away inside yourself? After all, if a touch of brilliance lies curled up inside of everyone, what purpose does it serve if it's only dimly perceived? Throughout our lives, we're told we will be defined by what we did. But what if we're really defined by what we didn't do? Meanwhile, the world watches on as seemingly organic individuals meet their fullest potential, forever leaving an impact on society, propelling us into the black box of a new world order. Today, we're going to talk about the hijacking of human potential, spending a few moments at a summer camp for gifted children, taking a closer look at the famous alumni, who they connected with thereafter, and the effects of these individuals on society. There's a lot to unpack. So let's begin. America's first research university that would go on to serve as the basis for modern medical education began at an end. The end of Johns Hopkins' life. Johns Hopkins was a Quaker man turned successful businessman and investor who left the equivalent of $150 million in today's money to establish a hospital, orphanage, and university in his name. Johns Hopkins donated a fortune with a specific vision to create better healthcare through education. And so, Johns Hopkins University opened in 1876 in downtown Baltimore. And I know it might seem strange, but we can't really talk about Johns Hopkins University without talking about Yale, an academic powerhouse 267 miles away from Johns Hopkins, where leaders of the brave new world have been molded and sculpted for centuries. From Samuel Morse and Noah Webster to Alan Dershowitz, Hillary and Bill Clinton, Meryl Streep and Anderson Cooper, a mere selection of the finest trained by Yale. But within the tombs of Yale, there exist several premier societies, once cloaked in a fog of secrecy. These societies are skilled at identifying unique individuals amongst the crowd. Famous members of Yale's notorious secret society, Skull and Bones, include America's most powerful families, the Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, and the Fords, as well as American presidents, William Howard Taft, George Bush, and George W. Bush. To state the obvious here, the nature of secret societies is that they're, well, they're secret. Their activities are secret. But it's rumored that out of Skull and Bones, future world leaders emerge who have and will bring about a new world order. And beyond those rumors, there's talk that Skull and Bones directly controlled the CIA. But is that really true, or is it only true in a world of speculation? What's the point of secret societies if they never exercise their power? All of this information comes into play when we acknowledge that out of Yale, there were four men who would play a pivotal role in shaping not only Johns Hopkins University, but the future of medicine and neurosurgery in America. Of those four men, there were three who belonged to the premier secret societies at Yale, two of them being Bonesmen. And that brings us back to Johns Hopkins University, which is most known for innovations in medical research, pioneering the field of genetic engineering, opening the first American School of Public Health, and making Johns Hopkins Hospital a top medical institution worldwide. But that's not all they're known for. Beginning in 1979, Johns Hopkins University offered a program that was set on identifying academically gifted seventh graders, providing students with accelerated classes and coursework on the weekends and throughout the summer. Dr. Julian Stanley was the mastermind behind the program, using the SAT, or Scholastic Aptitude Test, to identify exceptionally talented middle school students. Originally from Macon, Georgia, Dr. Stanley served in the Army Air Corps Chemical Warfare Division during the Second World War. When he returned, he completed his education at Harvard, taking a teaching position in educational psychology at several different colleges, eventually ascending to Stanford University, then finally, Johns Hopkins. Dr. Stanley was famous for his work in psychometrics, or the science of measuring mental capabilities and processes. He modeled what would become the Johns Hopkins Center for Talented Youth from a pre-existing study, the Genetic Studies of Genius series, which meant he measured the effects of short and long-term rigorous academic studies by following his students throughout their lives. Historically, the talent search involved taking the SAT in seventh grade. Admittance into the program required scores as good or better than 50% of college-bound juniors and seniors. And while the intense curriculum covers everything from math to robots to monsters, as far as I can tell, the program varies from student to student. Over the decades, programs that identified academically gifted individuals popped up at various institutions across the world. But the Center for Talented Youth has emerged as a leader in identifying exceptional talent, and boasts alumni like the co-founder of Google, Sergey Brin, founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, entertainer and Grammy winner Lady Gaga, and presidential candidate Andrew Yang. The ease of tracking gifted individuals who are processed through the Center for Talented Youth and other programs like it is important to keep in your back pocket for the rest of this video. I have no interest in villainizing or defaming gifted programs, the individuals who attend them, or Johns Hopkins University and its professors. I have simply provided what I deem as necessary context so we can learn more about the forces who circle like buzzards when even the faintest aroma of unused potential lingers in the air. After all, what's the point of a talent search if you're not going to activate the talent you found? The intoxicating tales of fame and success rarely address the most important factor involved in ascending to the upper echelon of society, gaining access to networks of power and influence. Luckily, to demonstrate this principle, I have a handful of famous alumni here, all bound by the strings of time and a web of connections that seem to lead back to one place. For example, Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google who studied computer science at Stanford, was the world's wealthiest Jewish bachelor until he married Anne Wojcicki, who, with her sister Susan, now the CEO of YouTube, initially gave Google the office space to start their business, all from the comfort of the Wojcicki's humble Menlo Park garage. Stanley Wojcicki, their father, was an employee at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, former advisor to the United States Department of Energy, and professor of physics at Stanford University. Now, this family tree has the ability to dominate the flow of information on the internet while banking and monetizing the human genome through 23andMe's genetic database, as well as the capacity to surveil and silence any voices of dissent. And that's before we ever touch CERN, the United States Department of Energy, or what it means for all of this power to fester under one roof. Are we having fun yet? Let's follow the web of connections even further. In 1998, Amazon founder and now Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos invested $250,000 in Google. And bear in mind, it's now been revealed how cozy Jeff Bezos and the CIA have gotten in the last decade. In 1999, the former CEO of Lockheed Martin founded InQtel, with the mission to identify and invest in camps developing cutting-edge technologies that serve the United States' national security interests. In other words, InQtel was the CIA's technology investment arm, a way for the CIA to get access to technology being created in the private sector. InQtel is named after Agent Q, the fictional MI6 agent who made gadgets and other wizardry for James Bond. Early on, InQtel invested in a company that provided satellite images and maps, and was later purchased by Google, becoming Google Earth. Over the years, InQtel has dominated Silicon Valley with taxpayer money. But that's not all. We can't forget Mark Zuckerberg, who reportedly spent 3 years with the Center for Talented Youth. In 2004, Zuckerberg founded a social network with endless data mining and surveillance capabilities. Facebook had only reached a few university campuses when it received funding from Peter Thiel, PayPal's co-founder and alumni of Stanford University, who also worked alongside NQTEL with his big data analytics software company. The next capital injections came from Peter Thiel's partners in a company called Axel, with partner and former Honeywell employee Jeff Rothschild in the front seat. The man in charge of the whole Axel operation was Jim Breyer. Now I know I'm throwing out a lot of names, but trust me, here's where it gets good. Big Papa Jim Breyer hails from New Haven, Connecticut. And according to his biography, he's the son of Jewish Hungarian parents. His father was an executive at the International Data Group, while his mother was an executive at Honeywell, a company where the previously mentioned Jeff Rothschild was an engineer. Honeywell not only makes consumer and smart home products, but they are also in the consortium that assembles all of the nuclear bombs in the United States arsenal. Jim Breyer is yet another Stanford alumni in this video, and since investing in Facebook, he's been pretty busy. He is a member on the Council of Foreign Relations, Legendary Entertainment, Circle Financial, and 21st Century Fox. He's previously served on the board of Walmart, Marvel Entertainment, The Walt Disney Company, and Dell Incorporated. Furthermore, Jim Breyer is a founding member of the Stanford Institute for Human-Assisted Artificial Intelligence, which launched this year. But wait, I'm not finished. NQTEL's first CEO, Gelman Louie, who also served on the board of the National Venture Capital Association, served on the board with Jim Breyer. But their connections don't end there. Before Louie was the CEO of NQTEL, Jim Breyer had invested in his company, MicroProse, a video game publisher and developer. Recently, Louie was presented with the Director's Award by the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. If we take a step back, it's quite a small but impressive web of connections from academia to Silicon Valley to Hollywood, all the way to Washington, D.C. You could definitely make the argument that if it's a program's goal to find the most gifted of students, it's a given that some of those students would move on to become successful and well-known. But isn't it so fascinating that the famous individuals from the Center for Talented Youth happen to be some of the most influential people in the entire world? People who control the lion's share of information and influence popular culture on the daily. Not only that, but these individuals, who are no doubt clever all on their own, function an awful lot like government assets. Think about it, they use their platforms to shut down public dissent, collect personal data, condition the public to constant government surveillance, eliminating the expectation of privacy altogether. One moment, our pop stars are wearing meat dresses, and the next moment, they're interviewing outlets for alleged government whistleblowers like WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. And heck, they even run for president of the United States. Sergey Brin didn't have the first or the best search engine. Mark Zuckerberg did not have the first or the best social media platform. Lady Gaga wasn't the first Madonna, nor will she be the last. And Andrew Yang, well, full disclosure, I've purposely avoided politics in this video. But what all these people have in common is that they all paid the price of admission. And while I'm airing out everyone's dirty laundry, let me be 100% transparent with everyone watching. If I researched all these connections and concluded, even for a fraction of a second, that the aforementioned individuals and government agencies were operating in the sole interest of United States national security for the benefit of the average citizen, then I would not have made this video. Not a chance. From Sergey Brin to Mark Zuckerberg, the Wojcicki family, and the Breyers, one thing unites these folks, and here's a hint, it's not their patriotism for the United States. The practice of selecting the best of the best, grooming them, and then tapping them to play their role on the world stage is a long-established practice, an echo of something very old. Not exclusive to Yale's Skull and Bones or headhunters who prey on harmless academic programs for talented youth, but it would seem that now, in the age of endless information, the methods of deception are equally as endless. Like little landmines for us to stumble over, should we keep the wool pulled down over our eyes? For me, the rise of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried has a lot of the same markers of Sergey Brin or Mark Zuckerberg's overnight success. The next clip I'm going to play for you is how after World War II, Alphabet agencies were formed and used against the American people to further the goals of not only the United States government, but of the global government, which I think is an essential bit of information as we move on to discuss things like Sam Bankman-Fried as a patsy or a fall guy, CBDCs or the adoption of the digital dollar, and more regulations on privatized crypto exchanges. Though traditional warfare had ended with World War II, the psychological warfare of an unseen enemy was just getting started. The masses were led to believe the world's boogeyman had been defeated, and that a global government organization, the United Nations, had been established to ensure peace and security in the aftermath of all the horror. Post-war United States was as strong as ever, with its workforce fueled by the American dream, at the center of which was family. But out of the rubble and ruin of battle rose a subversive force, one of many names and faces. Communism, cultural Marxism, Soviet involvement, Big Brother. Regardless of the title, the goal of this variety of psychological warfare was one of a new world order, brought about by a slow roll brainwashing of sorts, known as ideological subversion, made up of four stages. Stage one, demoralization, which begins in the classroom. Instead of teaching children to act morally in favor of themselves, their families, their communities, and their country, under the process of ideological subversion, demoralization takes place over a generation, where, in compulsory public schooling, a manipulated account of history is branded into the brains of every pupil, and unrighteous behavior is encouraged at school through television programming and other vehicles of propaganda. These lessons are reinforced at the university level, resulting in brainwashed cattle at every level of power: government, business, media, and education. If stage one is successful, the individual's perception of reality is so warped that any attempts to get them to recognize authentic information would be to no avail. After that, all that's needed is a good 2 to 5 years in order to implement stage two, the destabilization of a nation. This is the time that subverting party has the opportunity to crash the economy, ruin foreign relations, and disarm the defense systems just in time for phase three, the crisis phase, intended to usher in a change of power. Brownie points if it's a violent and dramatic change of power. The final stage is normalization, which is the welcome to your life as human cattle, please line up to get branded phase. Which might sound like a slight exaggeration, although if you think about it, not really. It's kind of curious that while all this ideological subversion was allegedly being implemented during the Cold War at the hands of the Bolshevik, Communist, Lenin, Marxist, Soviet, Red Scare, hide under your desk, y'all, we're about to get nuked, boogeyman, the United States government alphabet agencies formed post-World War II were utilizing the same psychological tactics, not just on foreign nations, but on regular old, unsuspecting Americans. In the early 1950s, the Central Intelligence Agency used major media companies for propaganda purposes in order to sway public opinion during the Cold War. A move right out of Bernays' playbook. This program was known as Operation Mockingbird, and in addition to controlling executives, reporters, and other staff within major media companies, the CIA also put forth their own agents as journalists of the so-called free press. Journalists who worked around the clock, especially after the assassination of President Kennedy, doing their patriotic duty to suppress truth from the American people, forcing witnesses to change their story, and silencing those who question the official narrative. Meanwhile, during that same time, the Federal Bureau of Investigation established their own counterintelligence program with the intention of surveilling, infiltrating, discrediting, and disrupting domestic political organizations, or basically any groups or individuals they deemed problematic. COINTELPRO's greatest hits, no pun intended, included infiltrating civil and women's rights movements and even groups who protested the Vietnam War. They went above and beyond, infiltrating groups and dismantling them by creating inner conflicts amongst members. Aggressive surveillance. Character attacks published by the Mockingbird media. And if all that didn't work, the FBI would attempt to break up marriages and push an individual to suicide. Both the FBI's COINTELPRO and the CIA's Operation Mockingbird were reportedly terminated in the 1970s, but the manipulation of the masses certainly didn't end with these programs. While newspaper, radio, and television dominated the first age of information, the computer age ushered in the second installment. In 1960, the United States Department of Defense began awarding contracts for what would now be considered the primitive internet. And in 1989, the World Wide Web as we know it, the same tool that billions of people utilize to this day, was developed by the European Organization for Nuclear Research, also known as CERN. In 1984, only 8.4% of American households had a computer, rising to 36% in 1997, and in 2015, 87%. In 2018, 95% of Americans reported owning a cell phone, and of that 95%, 77% reported owning a smartphone, meaning that the vast majority of Americans have a plethora of information at their fingertips at any given moment. In a few clicks, they can educate themselves on any topic imaginable, connect to individuals thousands of miles away, and learn about events before the news even has a chance to report on them. So much information and so little regulation. That's what Harvard Law professor and President Obama's administrator of the White House Office of Information was probably thinking nearly a decade ago when he started publishing his tactics to control the flow of information online. In an academic paper he wrote in 2008, Cass Sunstein managed to marry elements of Edward Bernays' manipulation of the masses with a touch of Operation Mockingbird and a dash of COINTELPRO tactics in order to counter information online that he suggested was a threat to the United States government. Sunstein defined conspiracy theories as an effort to explain some event or practice by references to the machinations of powerful people who attempt to conceal their role, at least until their aims are accomplished. While Sunstein admitted that some conspiracy theories are true, making them just conspiracies, like Project MKUltra, Watergate, Operation Northwoods, and the Bush administration illegally spying on US citizens after 9/11, he still advocated his policy for silencing conspiracy theorists, saying that governments should engage in the cognitive infiltration of the groups that produce conspiracy theories. And rather ironically, Sunstein recommended that government officials should utilize conspiratorial means to accomplish this, taking on false identities or even anonymity in online social networks, chat rooms, and in person, to undermine individuals and groups who investigate, discuss, and propagate theories. Though, it's curious, Sunstein didn't take aim at any other fallible variety of theory that resulted in harm to someone, somewhere. Scientific theories got a free pass. Sunstein's message can be boiled down to the following. If you outspokenly call for transparency in government and circulate research about events that might or might not have transpired or might not have happened the way the Mockingbird media said they did, Sunstein says the government doesn't trust you and therefore you need to be dealt with. Let us all take a moment of silence for Cass Sunstein. Press F to pay your respects, as he is a victim of ideological subversion. Or at least we hope so, because his treasonous and despicable behavior is otherwise inexcusable. While I'd like to tell you that Sunstein's efforts and the efforts of those before him to control the flow of information online have been unsuccessful, it only takes a quick glance at the present to recognize their fruit. Dissenting voices are silenced every day online for expressing even the most lukewarm controversial opinion, whilst appointed arbiters of truth are pushed into the public eye under the guise of being independent or alternative media. Today, only 6 companies control 90% of the American media outlets. And one company has the monopoly on the main gateway to the treasure trove of information the World Wide Web has to offer. That company is Google, owned by Alphabet Inc. The lines between corporations and governments aren't just blurred anymore. They barely exist at all. And just when people start to take notice that something isn't quite right, another distraction gets rolled out. Probably some breaking news headline on a polarizing issue into which well-meaning people throw their energy. Social media then becomes weaponized, dividing people into virtual armies that endlessly attack each other. White versus black, men versus women, Muslims versus Christians, gay versus straight, Antifa versus the alt-right. Ugh, it's also draining, so why don't you just sit back, relax, and watch a little Netflix? A company founded by none other than the grandnephew of Edward Bernays. By the way, Sam Bankman-Fried has been spotted at a grocery store in the Bahamas this week. Not a care in the world. Why do you think that is? A central bank digital currency, or CBDC, is the digital form of a country's fiat currency. New York's Federal Reserve Bank has announced its launch of the 12-week CBDC pilot program. So they'll be partnering with banking giants and issuing tokens and settling transactions through simulated central bank reserves as part of the pilot, which means they already have the solution ready and waiting for when a total fiasco with private crypto exchanges happened and customers lost billions of dollars. Problem, reaction, solution.
We're developing, through technology, an ability for consumers to measure their own carbon footprint. What does that mean? That's, where are they traveling? How are they traveling? What are they eating? What are they consuming on the platform? So, individual carbon footprint tracker. Stay tuned. We don't have it operational yet, but this is something that we're working on.
Where do we stand?
We central bankers. We have been operating as a monetary anchor in relation to the commercial banks and the private money. If we are not in that game, if we are not involved in experimenting, in innovating in terms of digital central bank money, we risk losing the role of anchor that we have played for many, many decades. And we have historical examples of period where the central bank monetary anchor was not there, and that precipitated crisis after crisis. That certainly was the case at the time of the free banking in the 19th century. Do we want to go back to those days? Probably not. I would say certainly not from our vantage point, as a result of which we have to respond to the demand for those digital payments in order to maintain the role of anchor that we have been playing regularly.
Hey, internet friends, this is going to be a quick one. I'm going to give you a rundown on the whole FTX crypto exchange financial drama, as well as cover the rather insidious and bigger story about FTX that mainstream media won't touch. Fair warning, this is such an annoying thing to explain because there's a lot of acronyms, but the recent FTX drama boils down to this. A crypto exchange took customers' money and invested it in unknown assets. And when customers went to pull their money out of the exchange, there was no money. Crypto exchange FTX and its founder Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF, imploded this week. To put it in perspective, FTX and its competitor Binance are the two largest exchanges in the world. Just like with Binance, with FTX, the customer can put in dollars or tokens, and you can trade these tokens. The way these exchanges make money is by charging a transaction fee when you exchange tokens. The transaction fee token that FTX uses is called FTT. It's a utility token that provides access to the FTX trading platform's features and services. And listen, I know it's funny money, but just stick with me here. Sam implemented a backdoor in the FTX bookkeeping, which let him alter his company's financial records without alerting their external auditors. That means when he transferred $10 billion of customer money to his sister company, Alameda, which he also founded, it went undetected. So early in November, CoinDesk, which is like a crypto publication, ran a report on FTX, which is headquartered in the Bahamas, and showed that basically the company was belly up. FTX had minimal liquidity because its founder had invested its customers' money in a bunch of unknown assets. Most of Alameda's assets were tied up in FTT, the funny money, so neither of Sam's companies had any liquidity. They only had fake money. Turns out the CEO of Binance decided to liquidate roughly $530 million worth of FTT around this time, which signaled FTX's customers to pull out too, and when they all did this at once, FTX saw an estimated $6 billion in withdrawals over the course of 72 hours. Which of course it couldn't fulfill because I just told you they didn't have any actual money. And hey, this is a very simplified version of events, but I believe I gave you the main highlights so we can move on to the bigger story. Back in 2019, Biden announced his presidential campaign, and just 2 weeks later, MIT graduate, early life Wikipedia tribe member, Silicon Valley's Sam Bankman-Fried, who is actually the son of Barbara Fried, who's a Stanford professor who happens to be the co-founder of Mind the Gap, a Democratic political fundraising organization based in Silicon Valley. Sam's brother, Gabe, is founder of Guarding Against Pandemics, an organization that advocates for public investments to prevent the next pandemic. And Gabe was a legislative correspondent for the U.S. House of Representatives and an advisor to large political donors in the Democratic Party. But that's not all. Aunt Linda Fried is an epidemiologist and dean at Columbia. She specializes in aging. And her husband is an expert in HIV/AIDS. They both have strong links to the World Economic Forum. You can read about them on the WEF's website. Anyway, Sam launched the FTX exchange 2 weeks after Biden announced his run for presidency. And somehow, in his late 20s, Sam became one of Biden's biggest donors. He reportedly has become the second largest donor to the Democrats right after George Soros. FTX was an overnight success and made Sam very rich. At his peak, he was reportedly worth $26 billion. And he'd even gotten celebs like Tom Brady and Giselle to promote his crypto exchange. Investment firm Sequoia Capital invested $213 million in Sam's company, only for Sam to turn around and invest $500 million in Sequoia Capital. Not only that, but FTX purchased 30% of Anthony Scaramucci's SkyBridge Capital. Once Biden was in office, he appointed Gary Gensler as the SEC chair. The daughter of Gary Gensler's boss at MIT, Caroline Ellison, is now the president of FTX's sister company. That's quite a web that's being woven when the SEC, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, is supposed to be protecting investors. In theory, they're supposed to be fair and not corrupt and impartial and all that. But I digress. FTX's head of ventures is Amy Wu, who used to work for the Clinton Foundation. And I'm undoubtedly going to butcher some of these names here, but it is what it is. FTX's policy and regulation head, Mark Wetchen, served as Obama's Commodity Futures Trading Commissioner. And there were reports that FTX wanted to spend over $1 billion on the Democrat Party for 2024. According to another report by CoinDesk, the Ukrainian government launched a crypto donations partnership with FTX in March of 2022. FTX was converting donations into fiat for a deposit at the National Bank of Ukraine. Aid for Ukraine was the official initiative that raised funds from the crypto community for the benefit of Ukraine's military and humanitarian needs. Quote, the Aid for Ukraine effort utilized FTX services to convert crypto funds received into fiat and send the donations to the National Bank of Ukraine, ultimately becoming the fifth largest charitable foundation assisting in the country's war effort, end quote. For the midterms alone, Sam gave Democrats $40 million from his now bankrupt crypto exchange. And it's pretty suspicious that the downfall of FTX happened right after midterms. So do you think Democrats will give back this tainted money after this whole scandal? Totally a rhetorical question, but I think it should be demanded of them. It's only fair, you know? But in all seriousness, I think the Sam Bankman-Fried character was set up to fall. His whole rise was too manufactured, too quick, and now his bankrupt company sets up the perfect example for people to demand federal control of cryptocurrency and trading, for them to demand government regulation. They fried the Bankman. You get it? After I published this first FTX video, Instagram marked my post as misinformation. So let's read why. This fact check was done by a lady named Yulina Malashenko. Sorry if I butchered your name, hon. I was so curious about your last name that I looked it up, and it turns out it's Slavic for messenger of God, which is just so perfect. She said my post was misinfo because there's no evidence that U.S. aid to Ukraine was laundered through the crypto exchange FTX. The article also references the tweet by the Ukrainian spokesperson who said that the allegations were absolutely false. And to Yulina, Yulana, I'm about to post my next video on Instagram here in a minute, and I'd really appreciate it if you calmed your commie tits, because everyone knows the difference between a conspiracy theory and a fact is 6 months. I did a video on fact checkers, so we're going to watch that in honor of top Ministry of Truth hon, Yulina. Hey, internet friends. Everyone knows my favorite website for fact-checking is Snopes. They are absolutely not biased in any way, and they're basically my outlet of truth in a world of lies. Not only do they debunk stories before they're ever formally investigated, so I have outlined talking points to help me navigate through any situation, but I'm sorry. What was that? You've heard me smack-talk Snopes and all their cats in previous videos? No. No, that was the old me. That was who I was before I went to the re-education center. Do you think the YouTube algorithm is still listening in, or can we just get on with the show? Before Before Snopes was ever Snopes, the site was used as an online encyclopedia known as the Urban Legends Reference Pages, created by husband and wife David and Barbara Michelson in 1994. The name eventually changed to Snopes, Snopes being the name of a family of characters who appear throughout the works of American writer William Faulkner. According to David, the user base eventually went from emailing questions about urban legends to emailing questions about politics. So organic, just a natural progression. One of the biggest stories they began fact-checking early on was 9/11. This is how Snopes became a fact-checking site utilized by mainstream media journalists and the average person typing in a question in the search bar. And the site eventually became so well-known and respected that they partnered with Facebook to check news stories on its platform. They're part of the reason why, in the age of fake news, if the average person or page on Facebook posts a story that's blurred out, warning you that the story is fake, you can attribute that censorship to the fact-checking organizations Facebook uses like Snopes, an arbiter of truth in a world of lies, an arbiter of presumed neutrality. So much public trust and money is placed into Snopes. Yet somehow, very little is known about how the operation actually runs. How many folks work at Snopes? What are their political leanings? Who funds the website? Who decided to make an urban legend hoax debunking website an authority on truth of every genre? Some of these questions we can answer in this video, but some of these questions just lead to more questions. Let me begin with an article by Daily Mail published in December of 2016. The article served as an exposé on one of the most respected fact-checking brands on the internet, detailing the inner workings of the Snopes organization, winding through David and Barbara's messy divorce, and after bringing forth the dark details, dared to ask the question, how could Snopes possibly be trusted to bring us the truth? Daily Mail is more of a tabloid newspaper, so one might tread lightly while absorbing any of their headlines. But in their article, they source their claims from a series of emails and documents from a court case. When a Forbes journalist reached out to David Michelson for comment on the Daily Mail article, he was shut down, saying there would be no further discussion because of legal reasons on matters of his divorce and how that affected business. So much for transparency, right? One of Daily Mail's claims was that at least one of Snopes' employees had ran for political office, which kind of destroys the illusion of neutrality in their fact-checking endeavors. After all, what if Snopes had hired fact-checkers from the Trump campaign or Fox News? Clearly, that would imply political bias. If you have any strong political leanings, do you have any business in fact-checking? So why is Snopes hiring partisan employees? While David says the fact-checking process is highly collaborative, so much so that several folks may contribute to a single article, often only one author is listed for its fact-checks, typically the person who wrote the initial draft. No mention of other individuals who collaborated. By design, this makes the audit process impossible. So once again, where is the openness? Where is the transparency in a reputable fact-checking organization that tells me what I can and can't post on social media? Everyone has bias. No person is infallible. Except for these fact-checkers, except for Snopes, who has put up a giant facade of neutrality, one that has served to micromanage public discussion, one that has served to tell us what is and isn't wrongthink. By nature, people are deeply flawed, even Snopes founder David Michelson, whose ex-wife claimed in legal documents that he embezzled $98,000 of company money and spent it on himself and prostitutes. He's since remarried to a former escort and porn actress who is one of the site's staff members. David had accusations of his own to sling back at his ex-wife, and eventually she sold her 50% stake in Snopes to Proper Media, a digital media company which provides advertising services for large-scale publishers. An article from 2018 relayed that Snopes had raised more than $835,000 on a GoFundMe campaign to engage in a legal battle over the site's ownership. Snopes does disclose their sources of funding on the website, but each time they do these crowdfunding campaigns, which they do often, the PayPal contributions are never listed as part of the publication. No one knows how it works internally, including me, said Brooke Binkowski, a former Snopes employee who was fired without warning. Fast forward to 2020, Snopes currently has 16 full-time staff, and the breakdown of their funding goes like this. A portion of Snopes' revenue is driven by advertising on the site. Presumably, these are majority Google advertisements, which probably works out pretty well for Snopes, given that Google pushes them to the top of the search anytime there's a hot topic brewing. So you can assume that they get a pretty good click-through rate in return on ads. The top five shareholders of Google include Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Vanguard Group, BlackRock, and T. Rowe Price Associates. Of course, Larry Page and Sergey Brin were famously disgruntled with the outcome of the 2016 election. So one might assume their company culture was built on their own personal belief system and biases that affects something as simple as search results and rank. But as far as Vanguard goes, or BlackRock, or T. Rowe Price Associates, these are investment management companies that have a degree of separation between the investors and their investments. So I can't infer political leanings there. Another huge source of income for Snopes was their fact-checking partnership with Facebook. And of course, the top five shareholders of Facebook are Mark Zuckerberg, Vanguard, BlackRock, FMR, and T. Rowe Price Associates. So we have some overlap here, but nothing totally conclusive from this information alone. Other income is generated from crowdsourcing between reader contributions, GoFundMe, and PayPal. And again, how do you trace these donations? Well, I can't. Now that we're done with the money, power, and scandal portion of this video, I want you to know I don't really care about petty Jerry Springer-style divorce highlight reels, marriages to streetwalkers, or how many cats you can legally have under one roof. The only interesting thing I could really find about David came from his resume, which stated he worked at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and a few other NASA-adjacent companies, but doesn't list in what capacity. I associate NASA with Operation Paperclip, Wernher von Braun, Walt Disney, and I associate JPL with Jack Parsons, one of the founders of the program, who was a leading occultist at the time and Aleister Crowley follower, which means he was into sex magic, part of the OTO Society, and close friends with Scientology's L. Ron Hubbard. Actually, now that I'm looking, David isn't the only person on his staff associated with NASA or JPL. To make matters even more illusory and magical, the financial records on the Snopes website begin with a one-time financial award from the James Randi Educational Foundation in 2016, an election year. The foundation was by magician and skeptic James Randi. Most of the other Snopes staff are remnants of MSM Publications, writers who migrated over from the Seattle Times, BuzzFeed, NPR, Motherboard, and The Atlantic. I'm going to roll my latest video on the whole Sam Bankman-Fried web of connections, and that's where we're going to end this whole show. Thanks so much, y'all, for watching and subscribing, and until next time, bye! Today, I'm giving you a roadmap of the tangled web of connections from Silicon Valley to Washington, D.C., then all the way back to Sam Bankman-Fried's now-for-sale penthouse in the Bahamas. Then, at the end of the video, hopefully we can answer this very important question. Should investigations into criminal activity be executed by the very parties implicated in the crime itself? I told you in the last video that the FTX scandal boils down to this. A crypto exchange took customers' money and invested it into unknown assets. An incredibly damning write-up about the company was published. Then FTX's competitor, the CEO of Binance, decided to liquidate hundreds of millions of dollars worth of FTX's utility token, which signaled to other crypto investors to do the same, but when FTX's customers went to pull their money out of the exchange, there was no money. A fella at the center of it all is 30-year-old MIT graduate, Silicon Valley-born Sam Bankman-Fried, who was pretty much a nobody up until the time that Joe Biden announced his presidential campaign. Just 2 weeks later, the FTX exchange was launched, and it was an overnight success, making Sam a very rich guy. Sam's father, Joseph, a tax law professor at Stanford, helped Sam raise money from investors to get FTX off the ground. Some of the investors include BlackRock, Sequoia, SoftBank, and Tiger Global. After FTX became an overnight success, Sam became the second biggest donor to Biden's 2020 campaign. Before helping Sam with the financials, his dad was working on a new IRS tax filing system. Apparently, Pops is pretty well connected because back in 2016, Joseph drafted tax legislation for the outspokenly anti-cryptocurrency Senator Elizabeth Warren. And curiously, in response to the FTX collapse within the last few days, Warren has called for regulation of the industry. Sam's mom, Barbara Freed, is also a Stanford professor, and she's co-founder of Mind the Gap, a democratic political fundraising organization based in Silicon Valley led by Stanford employees. Sam's brother, Gabe, is founder of Guarding Against Pandemics, which advocates for public investments to prevent the next pandemic. Gabe was a legislative correspondent for the U.S. House of Representatives and an advisor to large political donors in the Democrat Party. In addition to lobbying and advising lawmakers on pandemics, Gabe's Guarding Against Pandemics group endorses candidates on both sides of the aisle who pledge to champion pandemic prevention. My concern here is when they are spending on both sides of the aisle is that they are specifically cherry-picking politicians regardless of party lines that, in this case, will do the most medical tyranny in the event of the next scamdemic. Not only was FTX a partner of the World Economic Forum, even though they've tried to scrub the evidence from their website in the aftermath, but Sam's Aunt Linda Freed is a member of the World Economic Forum. Her day job is an epidemiologist and dean at Columbia, specializing in aging, and her husband is an expert in HIV/AIDS. Epidemiology, I should define, it's the branch of medicine which deals with the incidence, distribution, and possible control of diseases and other factors relating to health. So between Aunt Linda and brother Gabe with the virus shenanigans, it's giving me pause. It's giving me Vietnam-style PTSD flashbacks of Event 201 and ill-fitting purple sweaters and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So over at MIT, there's a fellow by the name of Glenn Ellison. He's the department head of economics and former boss of the Biden-appointed SEC head, Gary Gensler. Glenn is also father to Sam's girlfriend, Caroline Ellison, or the CEO of Alameda. FTX's head of ventures and commercial is Amy Wu, who used to work for the Clinton Foundation. FTX's policy and regulation head, Mark Wetjen, served as Obama's commodity futures trading commissioner. And it doesn't stop there. The general counsel of FTX, Wren Miller, had served as lead counsel to Gary Gensler at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. FTX's director of engineering, Nishad Singh, recently donated $1.1 million to Becca Balance's political campaign in Vermont, as well as $500,000 to the Democratic Party of Oregon. In total, it's been reported that Singh has spent around $8 million on pro-Democrat campaign contributions. And my point is, to summarize, all the high-level employees at FTX or Alameda had ties to the DNC, SEC, or Washington, D.C. But here's what's really weird. I can't find anything on FTX co-founder Gary Wang. There's three poor quality photos of him circulating, but not one interview or clip of him on the internet. His FTX profile picture on Sequoia Capital even has him turned away from the camera. Does he even exist at all? Most of the FTX contributions were to the Democrats, except for Ryan Salame, CEO of FTX Digital Markets, and his $23 million donation to the Republican Party, which is kind of nothing compared to the bags they've dropped and plan to drop on the DNC. But at the top, there is no red or blue, there's just one team, and it tells me they were looking for both parties to comply with what they had in store. Pandemic lockdowns and mandates, perhaps, or perhaps crypto regulation. It's apparent that Democrats definitely got more out of the deal since Ukraine partnered with FTX through the WF to receive donations. So since FTX makes money off of all of those transaction fees, all of the money funneling into Ukraine, FTX got a cut of. Then Sam turned around and gave a huge chunk of that to the Democrats, becoming the second largest donor behind George Soros. And reports were that FTX wanted to spend over $1 billion on the Democratic Party for 2024. By the way, Alex Bornikov, Deputy Minister of Digital Transformation of Ukraine, took to Twitter Monday night, and he officially denied the story about Ukraine's crypto fundraising effort. Quote, "A fundraising crypto foundation, Aid for Ukraine, used FTX official to convert crypto donations into fiat in March. Ukraine's gov never invested any funds into FTX. The whole narrative that Ukraine allegedly invested in FTX, who donated money to Democrats, is nonsense, frankly." End quote. But what did you expect him to say? Yeah, it's all true, na-na-na-na-boo-boo, sorry, pores. By the way, what oversight is there in these billion-dollar U.S. tax dollar aid packages to Ukraine? I'm guessing virtually none. On an even more disgusting note, CoinDesk reported that FTX's operations were run by Sam's inner circle of 10 roommates who all dated each other. They stole billions of dollars from their users and were having company-wide sex parties while doing so. One participant of these parties allegedly might have been New York Times writer David Yaff Bellamy, who wrote a fluff piece on Sam the scam artist this week and never once mentioned his donations to Democrats or Ukrainian money laundering. I say he might have been a participant because he tweeted about visiting Sam's penthouse in the past and bragged about encountering crypto-themed condoms. Gary Wang's hologram flickering in the corner probably witnessed the whole thing go down. Caroline's supposed Tumblr blog, which was active from 2014 until this past week, detailed this sexual dynamic between the FTX staff, you know, the polyamory, saying that her ideal guy was one who controlled most major world governments. And she said crypto was mainly scams and memes. It's almost too perfect to be true. It's like the very fabric of reality is unraveling. By the way, CoinDesk will do an expose on 10 coworkers living in a weird harem penthouse doing booger sugar all day, ripping off their clients to the tune of billions. But But the second one of CoinDesk's writers notices that all these folks have a common denominator, their TTs, Talmudic types, another acronym for your repertoire, he was fired. It very much looks like a case of Spook Family Robinson, a character set up to fail, most likely to bring in crypto regulation. So what do you think, internet friends? Should the people who are connected to this whole FTX fraud be the ones investigating their own wrongdoing? How can the SEC be impartial when Gary Gensler has barely a degree of separation from all of this? Can mainstream media be a reliable source when they're the ones getting whipped by Caroline at the penthouse? Can we vote our way out of this by electing more politicians who just line their pockets with these dirty dollars? Let me know your thoughts. You know, I always look forward to your comments. Thank you so much for watching, subscribing, and supporting my channel on Patreon. Bye!